Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Scientists agree that climate change is happening here and now, and that the sooner we act, the lower the risks and costs of catastrophic climate impacts. The documentary, Managing Risk in a Changing Climate, examines how scientists advised the Louisiana coastal region's decision makers and citizen stakeholders to create an action plan, something proactive cities across the globe are undertaking as well. In today's program, we'll talk with two Penn State experts about new projections for sea level rise and what cities around the world are doing to analyze and adapt to climate risks. But first, we begin our conversation with WPSU's Christian Berg, the writer, producer, and director of Managing Risk in a Changing Climate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A number of PBS stations around the country will be airing your documentary in recognition of Earth Day. Tell us a little bit about how and why you produced this half-hour film, which focuses on New Orleans, but really has a powerful message for decision makers and citizen stakeholders everywhere.
I came to this through WPSU. We do a lot of projects in partnership with various institutes and colleges around campus. And this one I was particularly interested in because it's a gathering of scientists from all kinds of different areas of expertise, and they bring together their knowledge, as we say, in an environment of shared discovery, in ways that they can take action now. And I was very fortunate. I worked on a lot of science programs on PBS, but the scope of this story is bigger than anything I've ever done before. I mean, there's so many aspects involved. There's the geophysics of the ice melting and raising sea levels. There's the ecosystem health of the wetlands that protect the coastal communities from hurricanes. There's the economics of ports closing by extreme weather. There's the ethics of poor people displaced by rising sea level, like the Native American community that we feature in Ile de Jean Charles. The Biloxi, Chittimacau, Choctaw tribe are having to move and are getting a major federal grant to move.
So the climate refugees are something that you certainly talk about in the film. You know, the film is narrated by Peter Coyote, whose distinctive voiceover work has earned him numerous Emmy Awards. And if there's a voice out there that says, sit up and pay attention, this is important stuff, it's Peter Coyote. Tell us a little bit about how you got him to work with you on this, and then we'll hear a short clip from the program.
Sure. Well, I had worked with Peter Coyote once before when I was producing a Native American history documentary. Peter works for a lot of high-profile PBS shows, but he will come and do more modest programs, and our budgets are modest, if he believes in the cause. And this one on the coming together of scientists and policymakers and community to take action was one that struck a chord with him.
Sea levels are rising all over the world. But in Louisiana, the sinking land amplifies this effect to the point where tide stations report rates of sea level rise among the highest in the world.
And so we face a problem of risk management, of how to manage risk of climate. What are the stakes? What are the odds? So what could happen, which is bad, and how probable, how likely is this? The product is called risk.
Depending on how much we reduce the burning of fossil fuels, climate scientists project greenhouse gas emissions will raise global temperatures from 2 to 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. With the increasing temperatures, sea level will rise by thermal expansion of ocean waters and by melting of land-based ice in Greenland, Antarctica, and from mountain glaciers. And new climate models show significant sea level rise could happen abruptly.
We're concerned that there are certain parts of the Earth system that have tipping points. And then we'd really like to know, so how bad is it if it tips? There's so much ice sitting in Antarctica and Greenland, and our expectation that the most likely future doesn't change that very much. But there's a slight chance that it will change a lot. Our studies of the physics of the ice say that the big piles on Greenland and Antarctica might fail in a warming world by large pieces breaking off rapidly into the ocean before they melt, raising the sea level really fast. if we limit warming, we may get a third of a meter by the end of the century. If we don't limit warming, it may be two-thirds of a meter or a meter, but recent science is pushing that top number higher. And in the worst case, it could be 2 meters, 3 meters, 4 meters. We're not even sure what the upper limit is.
Faced with this uncertainty, the stakes for the Louisiana Delta region are extremely high.
People don't realize that South Louisiana, New Orleans is an economic engine for the country. 32 states depend on this port. 90% of the offshore energy supply comes through this coast. When the port is closed, estimates are it costs the nation's economy about $300 million a day.
The implications are in my mind, of national significance, world significance. So we have an opportunity, and we need to do something about it.
But before any actions for climate change adaptation can be taken, policymakers have to assess the risk and create solutions based on sound science.
You know, we hear a lot in this film about this deep uncertainty, and we also hear about the need for resilient cities and so forth. So your focus is on New Orleans, but this would apply to even places like Pittsburgh, closer to home, where they are already experiencing the effects of climate change and are taking action. Tell us a little bit about that, Christian.
Yeah, a number of organizations of cities, one being the United Nations Compact of Mayors, and the other would be the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program, who provide money to help communities gather the scientific teams and to make their plans. The Compact of Mayors is very exciting because over 100 American cities sent representatives to Paris to the climate talks to make commitments for making action plans. And not all of them are there yet, but Pittsburgh is rolling out their new action plan in a matter of weeks.
And in fact, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto seems to be ahead of the curve. He's already working on their third climate action plan, and they have a chief resilience officer in place, a CRO.
That's right. And we're hoping that this film will be used by other chief resilience officers in other cities so that we can show the extreme story of New Orleans, and then to have people come on and say, okay, well, this is the climate risk in our area, and these are the steps that we're taking to make an action plan.
I mentioned the word deep uncertainty because that's a term that you use in your film. And scientists often talk about this deep uncertainty about how quickly the ice sheets will melt and what that means in terms of sea level rise. They also say that we will not have sharp or definitive answers anytime soon. And a lot of people read that as, okay, they're uncertain, so we should wait. And your film seems to be making the case that uncertainty is no reason for complacency. In fact, that uncertainty makes preparation all the more urgent. Explain that, because I think that's a disconnect for a lot of people.
Yeah. It was really fascinating, and it was an extremely iterative process. You know, I even hesitate to even call myself the writer of this, because it went back and forth between experts, and I was corrected so many times and so grateful for the corrections. But there is deep uncertainty as to what the impacts will be, as to how people will respond to it, and how you get to those decisions under this cloud of uncertainty. There's a strategy behind that, and there's a science behind that as well.
That was WPSU science producer Christian Berg, the writer, producer, and director of Managing Risk in a Changing Climate. Up next, we'll talk with two Penn State scientists who are featured in the film, climatologist Richard Alley, an Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences, and an expert on the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, and Klaus Keller, a professor of geosciences, whose research is focused on how to design scientifically sound, economically feasible, and ethically defensible climate risk management strategies. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to get back to this idea of deep uncertainty. The film does focus on adapting to climate change and managing risks. Before we go any further, what do we know for certain, Richard Alley, and what is still unclear? And in that context, what does scientific uncertainty mean anyway?
Yeah, well, we know that with very high certainty that a place like New Orleans has to deal with change. They cannot get away from it. It will happen. And that it could be really large, really fast, and really bad. The best you could hope for in New Orleans, it's still built on a giant pile of mud, which is sinking under its own weight. The Delta has eroded. The storms are going to get it. But sea level rise could be, say, 3 feet by the time our students are old, or it could be 2 feet, or 4, or 15. And that's really deep uncertainty.
In fact, today's estimates for rising sea level are higher than your previous projections. And so I'm wondering what's driving those higher estimates, and what is your new understanding of how Antarctica ice has behaved in the past and how sensitive it will be to future climate change?
Right. So it's very clear warming is melting mountain glaciers, putting water into the ocean. That makes sea level rise. Warming is causing ocean water to expand. That makes sea level rise. But the giant ice sheets have something close to 200 feet of sea level locked up in them. And so if you just say, what's the worst could happen, it's really bad. And what we have been learning is that certain times, certain places, the possibility for the flow of those ice sheets to change is real. If we turn up the thermostat high enough, it really could happen and we could get a lot more. Not the whole 200 feet in a short time, but a chunk of it that would be really distressing for coastal people.
Why, Klaus Keller, is it important to talk about these deep uncertainties versus worst-case scenarios or most likely to happen?
Well, it's about trade-offs, and how you navigate this trade-off depends on what you can get from the actions you take. Now, the question here is, worst-case scenarios are interesting, but they are by definition not very likely, and we have to account for the full range of outcomes to navigate this trade-off wisely. To come back to the question of deep uncertainty, this is maybe an example that is helpful to illustrate the concept. When we drive with a car, we know there's a risk of being hit and needing a seatbelt, which is deeply uncertain because if you ask 5 experts, you maybe have 10 different estimates. We still take precaution by having a seatbelt. So uncertainty, or even deep uncertainty, is not an excuse for avoiding actions to mitigate those risks.
You talk about the need for us to act quickly and collaboratively. So I want to talk a little bit about who's involved with you in helping cities make these really, really important decisions based on costs and benefits and the possibility of this or that happening.
Well, this is a larger project, and there are many different projects around the world and in the U.S., but when you look at the disciplines that are relevant to think about the problem, this has to do with engineering, how to build a levee, with economics, what are the costs, with social scientists, how will people move in response to changes in risks, with philosophers, what are the norms and ethical standards that we need to abide by, with geoscientists to think about what are plausible scenarios of sea level rise, all the way to computer scientists and geographic information scientists to think about the spatial extent. The problem here is that if you look at this problem just from one specific dimension, you may miss key concepts. And it's the emergent properties from the confluence of different disciplines, which makes this a hard but also an interesting problem.
Richard Alley, how do citizens make sense of the fact that at the highest level of our government, the White House, for example, is saying we will probably exit the Paris Agreement? On the other hand, you've got governors and mayors throughout the country and, in fact, throughout the world who are saying it doesn't matter what happens at the federal level. We are going to plan now.
Yeah, well, I think you see many people are in the lead. And a lot of places, you mentioned Pittsburgh, the folks working in New Orleans, people who are leading, they are faced with reality. They have to deal with it. And they have said, we're elected to help people. We're going to do this. And if the leadership is not coming from elsewhere, it will come from us. Ultimately, it's each of us and it's all of us. And so ultimately, what does happen at the federal level will matter, too.
You know, between 2011 and 2015, there were 577 climate-related natural disasters declared nationwide, and almost half of those, Klaus Keller, 263 of them occurred in states that were led by governors who deny climate change. Meanwhile, recent surveys show that 67% of Americans believe in climate change and support climate action. So what can concerned citizens do if they're concerned about this?
Well, for one,
the climate, or let's say the oceans, don't care which party you start to elect. This is geophysical reality. It hits people on all sides of the debate. The other point discussed before is that adapting to climate change is something that is often very clear to many people, and it is easier to find consensus for. The mitigation side, of course, reducing CO2 emissions, is something which is a longer time perspective and much more harder to find consensus for, because the benefits are distributed over time and space. You know, the benefits of reducing emissions are in the future. Now, we value the future, but it is more diluted in the future than the benefits of adapting, for example, to sea level rise.
Richard Alley, you had something to add.
Yeah, there's a very interesting set of surveys that came out recently. And when asking Americans sort of, do you believe in climate change? Many of them do, but there still remains some doubt. But when asking Americans, do you believe that there are wise solutions? All of a sudden, the belief went way up. So how it's framed and looking to building things that work and help us, people are really in favor of that.
Well, speaking of how it's framed, you do a lot of work with decision science. And in fact, there's actually a center of decision science at Columbia Business School. And how the question is framed, as Richard Alley says, makes a huge difference. So for example, if the Trump administration says that America's first energy plan will save America $30 billion, that means one thing. But if you take that down to the personal or concrete level, that's only, you know, maybe $29 a year to roll back protections for water and for air. So how important is it to frame things that are concrete and personal?
Well, I think it's clear that if you make a decision salient, meaning relevant to you, and you point out ways to improve compared to a status quo where we are right now, it is much easier to engage and see the solution as if you have a very abstract and very large problem, which is very diffuse. And this is also one motivation why we focus on the New Orleans case, because I think it's a prime example how people see a problem, they work the problem, they think about the trade-offs, and then they make a decision and they implement a decision, and they re-evaluate the decision as time evolves. So coming back to your decision about the description about Pittsburgh having a revised plan, it's not bad to revise a plan as information evolves. So I think the way decision science can help here is to map out the trade-offs and how you navigate it. It is not the role of decision science to say you should go here. It's more like map makers that give you a map of where you can go from here, but the decision makers need to make the choice and need to get going if they want to move from here to there.
And there's lots of emphasis on this map being a living document, something that is updated periodically.
Yes. Well, because the issue about uncertainty is it is not an cry for inaction, but also it is an opportunity to learn and to adjust the plan as you learn. It might be that the situation is worse, or it might be the situation is actually not as bad as we think right now, and you want to adapt to that. One point that could also a way how decision science can help you is if you find a strategy that actually works right now on the both assumptions, it could be worse or not so bad, and then you adjust as you go along, it is easier to buy into a strategy like this because you can basically commit to this right now. This is not about we have to eliminate all the uncertainty. It is coming up with a plan that works under all plausible states of the world.
Right. So you will hear people saying we have to get rid of this government policy, this group, this regulation, because it has costs. But it has benefits, too. The regulations generally now are done with cost-benefit analysis, and the benefits exceed the costs. And so be very clear when you're looking at these that you look both at costs and benefits when making decisions.
One way to think about this is to have the analog, you know, transitioning to sanitation in cities. Or we do often things that take a lot of transition time, but at the end, it actually is goods, and there's initial value of pain you have to go through to have a long-term benefit. And we've done this again and again before.
Give us an example of that.
Well, in Richard's book, it's a very good example is when we, in medieval times, sanitation in cities was very rudimentary and a very non-pleasant affair. And then to go to sewage treatment systems requires a lot of upfront investment. And some people will be out of work and have to transition into other occupations. Now, that's a problem we solved in the past, and I think the world is a better place with this. Think about chlorofluorocarbons in the ozone hole. This is a problem that was recognized. We had a solution. It took a long time. The benefits are delayed. Again, we solved the problem. Think about, there are many examples like this where there is a long-term transition, which at the end people do what now is judged to be the right thing, because they actually see the benefits, even if right now it's an upfront investment.
Richard Alley, tell us a little bit about how your projections for sea level rise have changed over the last decade or so. Why? What are you seeing in the ice melt that's changing your view of what could happen?
Yeah, some of it is that nature has gotten ahead of us, and things that we did not expect to occur as soon or as rapidly or as much as have happened. And so you look at, the ice shelf fell apart because meltwater puddled and broke through and cracked open the crevasses, and then the ice behind it sped up 6 or 8 fold, and my goodness, that's raising sea level, and it's 100 years ahead of schedule. And then we're learning. And, you know, Klaus is completely correct that the learning curve, if I drive somewhere, I have a very nice lady in my phone tells me where to go. But when we hit traffic, she tells me a different place to go because she learned something. And we as scientists are trying to do the same thing.
Sea level rise, we know, won't be uniform around the world. But as we think about the winners and losers, what areas of the country are you most concerned about?
Yeah, so it's going to be harder to build a wall around Florida because the seawater will sneak under the wall through the caves down there and come up behind it. There are real worries. The really valuable, beautiful places we might build walls around, but what happens to the poorer and less valuable places? There's also the real worry. I talked to an economist once who said, well, the worst thing that could happen is we'd lose all the valuable things near the sea. But that's not the worst thing that could happen. The worst thing would be we'd build a wall, we'd tell everyone they're safe, they'd build lots more valuable things, and then we'd lose all of them.
Wow. You talked earlier, Klaus Keller, about all of the disciplines that need to be at the table. Talk, if you would, about citizens, ordinary citizens being at the table. And when you work with cities on devising these resiliency plans, how do you get citizens to the table?
You need to talk with citizens. It's very simple. But you need to have a dialogue which is accepting of the concerns and lets people keep face. So there are strategies in having workshops, there's strategies to actually have interviews, and then to make very clear inferences from the interviews about what the values are and what their mental model is, how they, just different stakeholders, think how actions affect outcomes. And it's really important that we have a map of how values and their mental models work, because there is a discrepancy between those mental models of the stakeholders and the experts. And none of them is often perfectly right. And you learn a lot by overlaying them and seeing there's a common understanding and then the edges where the stakeholders don't overlap. And the task is to come to a joint understanding where the analysts understand the values and can account for them. But then also, of course, the decision makers, stakeholders understand how actions lead to outcome.
You know, and if you go back to the example in your film, Managing Risk in a Changing Climate, you look at New Orleans, where the land is literally sinking. Land is being lost at an unprecedented rate. And so one of the solutions is to dredge the sand and really to create what existed before there was disruption by man. But in the end, what looks like a solution, though, leaves commercial and recreational fishermen at a loss.
Yes. And this is what makes this problem really, really, really hard. It is not just about building a levee. This is about how to find a portfolio of different instruments, levees and restoration of wetlands, that actually achieves the best you can do. And the point here is that this is also a tension, not just between building roads and building levees, but having restoration of wetlands and having fisheries or having the ability to navigate the channels. So this is what makes this problem really hard, but it also is something which leads to humbleness, or should lead to humbleness, of the analyst, because there is not a single solution which just works for all. This is something where we have, where the decision makers have to navigate the trade-offs between winners and losers, and one has to think about what is acceptable for the people at the table.
To what extent are cities around the world sharing information, because there is so much wasted time and resources if each city is reinventing the wheel? Richard Alley.
You see some places that are way in the lead. They're talking to each other. They're moving forward. It's beautiful. There's room for more. There's plenty of opportunities to share the knowledge better. And I actually sort of am optimistic in a way, not only through the work that's been done in Klaus's center in Scrim, but through work such as this film, because people will see this. And it is a beautiful testament to what is possible when citizens and scientists, scholars of all sorts, get together with respect and try to find the way forward.
But I know that you have talked face to face with legislators, and you've left thinking they get it. They understand what risks we're facing, and I think they're on board, only to find out that they'll say in public, there are too many things that are unknown, or the climate is always changing, or it's arrogant to think that humans can create global climate change. And so I would think those would be things that would make you pessimistic about the future.
It would be very easy to get pessimistic, but ultimately, reality is out there. We can use it to be better off. And many of our legislators, they lead, but they also lead from behind. They're waiting for us to help them a little bit.
Back to you, Klaus Keller. If citizens are going to help lead their politicians rather than the other way around, how can we impress upon them that we are concerned about this and want action?
Well, inform yourself, understand the problem, and then make your voice heard. Let's think about it this way. Thinking back at other problems, you know, the ozone hole or human health, it is mostly the understanding that we have a problem and then voicing it which changes it. And it also is, it's not just the route through politics, it is also our own actions. You know, we do have a role to play in here in terms of how we use fossil fuels and how we live our daily life.
Richard Alley.
Yes, that survey of attitudes on climate change, that almost everyone agreed there were great solutions, almost no one was talking about it.
You know, you've also said, Richard Alley, that when today's students are old, average temperatures will be hotter than our highest temperatures are now, that we'll lose 40% of our ability to work outside. I mean, if you think about that, wow, now is not a time for complacency for sure.
Right. If we don't change our energy system, but we can build a sustainable energy system that's economic, that makes a transition, that takes care of people, and gives us a world that is energy rich and successful.
In fact, experts are saying that already there are well over 2 times more solar workers than there are coal miners.
Yes, so the opportunities are fantastic, and we are the first generation that knows that we can move to a sustainable energy system.
And unfortunately, we will have to leave it there. That was climatologist Richard Alley, an Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences, and Klaus Keller, a professor of geosciences, both at Penn State. They're featured in the National Science Foundation-funded documentary, Managing Risk in a Changing Climate, produced by WPSU's Christian Berg. The film is available online. For more information, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.